Thank you, Heather, and thank you to all of you for coming this evening and to the commissioners for making this evening possible. My job here is to actually explain the details of the rules that we're debating, and it's a real pleasure because I believe we are at an unprecedented crossroads in media policy. For the first time since the mid-70s, there's a serious ongoing reconsideration of U.S. media ownership regulation, and I think that's an incredibly appropriate thing to do. Why? Because since the 1970s, there's been a tremendous change in the media environment. We've seen the emergence of numerous new media channels. Just to name a few, the number of television stations has tripled since the mid-70s, the number of stations the average U.S. household can receive. Cable television and satellite television has transformed the media landscape to the point where now 86% of U.S. households subscribe to some form of cable or satellite television, with the average station, average provider getting 55 or more channels per household. Second, the other thing that's happened is there's been some dramatic changes in the legal environment. First is the 1996 Act has put a new requirement on the FCC that they must reconsider their media ownership regulations every 2 years and consider whether they're necessary and repeal those that they believe that are no longer necessary in the public interest. This represents a dramatic change because it puts the burden of proof on the FCC to re-justify its rules every 2 years. The second thing that's really changed is a series of court decisions that have struck down at least three of the rules that are currently under consideration on various grounds asserted under the 96 Act. So the FCC has very much been spurred to act by a number of judicial decisions that have found that certain of these media regulations have not been justified by law. And the last thing that's really changed things is some new thinking on the role of information in the new economy. You hear a great deal about how the advent of network technologies and network economics and the Schumpeterian competition and all these other fancy concepts are changing the way we need to regulate them. And actually, there's some new theories out there, and it's really a welcome thing to sit back and think about how these new high technology theories are really going to change the media environment. So that's opened up a moment that we're now going to very much reconsider everything that we're going to do, and I think that that's a very appropriate thing. The big fight is over what the change is going to be. There are six rules currently going to be voted on by the FCC on June 2nd, and I will generally lump them into three categories. The first category is restrictions for those of you who have the handouts. I'm now on this slide that's marked number three. Three families of rules. The first are restrictions of the number of the same media you can own in any local market. That is, how many television stations can one entity own in Atlanta, and how many radio stations can one entity own in Atlanta. The second family is local restrictions across media. In other words, in Atlanta, can you own a radio and a television station? Not the same type of media, but different types of media under the same ownership. And can you own a broadcast outlet and a newspaper within the same market? And the third family is national restrictions. First, how many television stations can you own nationwide? And second, can one entity own more than one television network? As you can already see, these different types of rules strike people in very, very different ways and get at very different problems and raise different sets of concerns. Let's go through them one at a time. Turning to slide four. Local ownership limits within media, focusing on radio. The original radio rule prohibited any entity, any corporation or person from owning more than one station in any market. This was originally developed in the late 1930s when there was only a handful of radio stations. Well, what has happened since then is a dramatic proliferation in the number of radio stations that are now available in most cities in the United States. The second thing that's happened is a general recognition that there's a fundamental insight that as you have more outlets in one market, the concern that two of them might be owned by the same person goes down. In other words, if you're looking at a market like New York City, the fact that two of the radio stations are owned by the same person is less troublesome than it would be in a much more concentrated market. And the FCC revised its rules from barring anyone from owning more than one station to what I'm calling a tiered approach, which is represented on the table that you have in front of you. It divides each market into tiers based on the number of radio stations that operate in that market. If you look at it, the highest tier is for those where there's 45 stations in a market, and the lowest tier is for one that's 14 or fewer. In the highest tier, one entity can own up to 8 radio stations, and the lowest tier, one entity can own up to 5. And it progressively gets more and more permissive as more and more outlets operate in the same market. What's interesting about this is that the tiers, when you're looking at the number of people operating in the market, you only focus on radio stations. That is, if there are 45 or more radio stations, will allow you to have more concentration in the ownership, because when there's more people operating, that's of less concern. The television rules adopt a similar approach. Again, the original rule prohibited anyone from owning more than one television station in any market. The insight became, in New York City, where you have a great number of television stations, that's much less troublesome than it would be first when these rules were enacted back in the most recently in the 1970s, and it goes on that in other markets that are smaller, that sort of concentration might be more concerning, raise more concerns. Again, the current rule takes a tiered approach. If there are eight or more independent voices in the market, you can allow combinations of television stations as long as they're not in the top four. If there are seven or fewer television voices in the market, you can't co-own two television stations. Again, a tiered approach and focusing only on television stations. How many other television stations are operating in the market in determining whether we should be more permissive? I should note that this rule was one of the ones invalidated by the courts in 2002. I'll get back to why after I explain the next rule. The next rule is a limit on radio television cross-ownership within the same market. When is it okay for someone to own a radio station and a television station? In the original rule, you could not own an AM station and an FM station, or an AM station and a television station, or an FM station and a television station. There was an absolute bar to owning more than one particular kind of broadcast station. Again, they started to realize, the FCC in its ruling said, you know, in certain markets that are sufficiently deconcentrated, having an AM-FM combination might not be so bad. Having a radio-television combination might not be so bad. And again, they adopted a tiered approach. If there are 20 more voices in a market, they'll allow a combination of two television stations and six radio stations, or there's some combinations there that you can allow some exchange in between them. And going down to the bottom tier, when there's nine or fewer voices, you limit them to one television station and one radio station. The thing I'll point out about this tiered approach, when you're counting up the number of voices to understand how deconcentrated that particular market is, you don't just look at radio and television. You look at the entire media marketplace. They include cable television in that marketplace. They include newspapers, daily newspapers in that marketplace, thinking that that's part of the richness and the diversity of the market. That stands in stark contrast to the television and radio rules when you only looked at one kind of media and treated them as if they were each independent. It is that distinction between the two sets of rules that caused the courts to strike down these rules. In other words, they're saying if television and cable are substitutes for broadcasting, that makes it okay for a greater degree of concentration to occur for the purpose of radio-television cross-ownership. Courts asked, why isn't that same degree of diversity taken into account when you're determining how many radio and television stations you own? The point is, the law and the courts require a certain amount of consistency and logic across the rules. And that's one of the things that has led to this overarching proceeding, because the invalidation of these rules is what caused the FCC to have to reconsider them to begin with. The fourth local ownership rule is the one that prohibits newspaper broadcast cross ownership. For example, everyone knows the Chicago Tribune is owned by the Tribune Company. They also own WGN in Chicago. Otherwise, this rule would typically, if there were nothing else going on except the rule itself, you would think that's an absolute bar. Several things. First, I'd point out about this rule. It does not adopt a tiered approach. In other words, even if you're talking about New York City, which is perhaps the most diverse in terms of number of voices, radio, media market in the U.S., if this rule were to apply as written, it would bar any newspaper from owning a single radio station in New York. Second thing I'd point out about this is that it does apply to all broadcast media. It's not just a newspaper television cross-ownership, it's a newspaper any broadcast outlet cross-ownership restriction. And the last thing is that, in fact, these sorts of combinations do exist. There are 54 broadcast newspaper combinations operating in the United States, which have either been grandfathered in or been granted permanent waivers. So in fact, we have a world in which some cities have a combined ownership of newspaper and broadcast and some that do not. This rule was upheld by the Supreme Court in 1978 and is currently up for reconsideration by the FCC. The last two rules that are being reconsidered deal with national ownership, and that's a limit on how many stations one company can own nationwide. This is not about local ownership. It's not about concentration here in Atlanta. It's about whether a company that owns stations in Los Angeles can also own them in New York, Atlanta, and Chicago, and the like. It's the total number you can own nationwide, independent of the local ownership restrictions. Originally, the rule restricted anyone to owning only 3 stations. It's been liberalized over the years to allow 5, 7, 12 stations until in the 1996 Act, Congress passed a statute liberalizing it so you could own any number of stations nationwide, subject to one proviso. You can own any number of stations provided that the total reach of the stations is no greater than 35% of the national market. So instead of counting up number of stations, what you're doing is counting up number of potential viewers. The FCC, pursuant to its mandate under the Biennial Review Act, reconsidered this in 2000 and declined to overturn the rule and left the 35% cap in place. That decision not to revise that rule was invalidated by the courts, and in fact, there was another one of the rules that was struck down that triggered reconsideration of this proceedings. The reason this has become politically very salient is subsequent, because of the Viacom's acquisition of CBS and Fox's acquisition of Chriscraft, two of the broadcast networks currently own in excess of 35%, television stations that reach in excess of 35% of the market. And unless, if this rule is not changed, they will be forced to divest additional numbers of those properties. And that has produced a good deal of the dynamics that have raised this to the fore. The last rule is called the dual network rule. It historically, when passed, prohibited anyone from owning more than one network. And in fact, it was originally passed because of the old NBC red and blue networks when they were owned by the same person, by the same company. Since that time, there's been a number of pressures that have caused this to be loosened. First is the advent of cable television. We currently have an excess of 200 television networks operating, and as I pointed out, 86% of U.S. households subscribe to some form of multi-channel television. Obviously, that's not available to everybody, but it does represent a dramatic change in the media environment that's prompting reconsideration of the rules. The other thing that's prompting reconsideration of the rules is, again, merger activity. When Viacom acquired CBS, Viacom also held an ownership interest in UPN. At that point, you had one company owning two networks, CBS and UPN. In response to that problem, the FCC passed a regulation liberalizing the ability to own more than one network. You could own more than one so long as one of the networks was not one of the big four. In other words, ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox. As long as it was a UPN and WB or some of the other newer networks, I guess Pax TV is now tracked by Nielsen as a major broadcast network, co-ownership between those networks would be permissible under the new rule. It's not permissible if one of them is one of the four major broadcast networks. And that is currently under review as part of this. Those are the 6 rules. Those are the 6 rules that exist today that are being debated and will be voted on whether they should be changed on June 2nd. What are the issues they're fighting over? Several things I just touch on once, quickly. First, I would urge you to consider this about more than just a question of regulation versus deregulation, and more about big media versus not big media. What we'll find out is, because some of them are focused nationally, some of them are focused locally, some of them are focused on certain broadcast outlets, and some of them are focused on cross-ownership across broadcast outlets, in fact, what you'll find is that the issues are much more subtle, and that people who want to promote and preserve diversity may find that you'll support liberalizing some and not support liberalizing others. And what it really, in my opinion, calls for is a much more sophisticated and nuanced approach and a very serious dialogue. The second is, we have to take into account the fact that we have a great deal of new media. In addition to the major television media, we now have the internet, we now have satellite radio, we now have a whole variety of new ways to reach people. And one thing I can guarantee that these new media will do, they'll change things. They'll change things in ways that no one here can foresee. And in fact, they'll change things in ways that businesses can't foresee. What those of us who've been in this, who've tracked media issues long enough remember is that the biggest opponent to the advent of VCRs was the movie studios. Why? They believed that would lead to wide-scale copying. It reminds me very much to what's happening now with Napster and the radio industry. The recording industry is deathly afraid of them. As it turns out, the VCR was the best thing that could have ever happened to Hollywood. By creating Blockbuster and now media sales, it basically created new revenue streams that they didn't know how to exploit. Did it change things? Yes. Was it disruptive? Scary? Yes. Was it necessarily a bad thing? No. The hard thing is, we have to find, in response to change, the change will inevitably cause things that used to be successful and we were very comfortable with to no longer be successful and do things we're comfortable with. And we have to think very much outside the box in response to the new environment. The other things I would say is, There's a radical new way of looking at things about the economics of information, where people are throwing around a lot of very fancy theories that I think make the whole world much more interesting and open up the policy space and gives us options of ways we can respond that we never dreamed about. And the last thing is Professor Adelstein mentioned efficiencies of group ownership. This is something the FCC itself has recognized as it's deregulated a number of these rules somewhat over the years. But what I would point out to you is that, in fact, those sorts of efficiencies can be quite different when you're looking across media instead of within a media. I'll give you one example. There was in Boston a newspaper long ago, before we had a second newspaper in Boston, who wanted to start up as a daily. And they told the FCC, unless you let us acquire a television station, so that we can take the news that we've already collected and run it out through as many outlets as we can. Once we've collected the news, we've incurred all the costs. What we need to then do is turn that information and roll it out into as many outlets as they can. And that's how they're going to be successful and compete with the Boston Globe. The FCC declined to waive the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership. And things turned out exactly what the newspaper predicted. The newspaper failed. What's interesting is you have an example there where allowing cross-ownership under certain circumstances has the potential to actually diversify the print environment. And if there's no cross effects, it wouldn't necessarily have an adverse effect on television. I'll give you another example from Nashville. The WB and UPN outlets are owned by the same people. They use a joint sales force, and they say that they could not otherwise afford to operate because neither one of them has enough audience to justify a sales force of their own. Niche radio stations say the same things. Well, I guess what I'm saying is these efficiencies should not, the FCC has already acknowledged some of them, and I wouldn't dismiss them quickly. What I do think we need to do is take a very hard and very sophisticated look at what's going on to try to figure out how concerned we should be. The last two points I would make are legal considerations. First, the new statute requires that everything be grounded on empirical evidence, real-world facts and studies. And one of the things that I think that will be ultimately beneficial, no matter what happens on June 2nd, is a lot more attention will happen to what's happening in the real world and what's really going to make a difference than it previously happened. The other thing is, the courts have emphasized that the rules can't contradict each other in logic. If you're going to count newspaper and cable for the purposes of one rule, you should count it for the purposes of the other rules, or at least explain why you're not. In the end, for the lawyer and me, that's very appealing. The idea of consistency and bringing these logics across is tremendously attractive in terms of consistency and making it all work. The last thing I'll say, I'll just close with the following statement. I think this is a tremendously important moment. I think it's a great thing that there's so much attention and focus on the ownership rules. It is a welcome and long overdue development. The other thing I'll say is this. This is just the first of many issues that are in a long line of them queued up for the FCC to deal with. Digital television and public interest obligations, whether they have to be carried, the must-carry environment, whether digital stations have to be carried by local cable television stations. There's two enormous broadband proceedings that will affect the internet content and the way the internet is being regulated out there. And I would encourage all of you who are interested in these issues, this is just the most salient and the most immediate of a long series, and I encourage you to stay involved and continue to engage in dialogues with this. And I'm just glad that Commissioners Copps and Edelstein have made this all possible for us to be part of this dialogue. Thank you.